From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're skeptical, even a little, you're going to be suspicious and probably outraged at some of the quote-unquote scientific projects conducted by the U.S. government into mind-reading and other paranormal projects. In her new book, the journalist Annie Jacobson explores the history of these experiments. The idea was to get the upper hand on the Soviet Union during the Cold War. So the U.S. did experiments on out-of-body experiences, ESP, dowsing, spoon bending. It sounds crazy, most of it, but Jacobson is interested in what kind of belief would make so many people spend so much time and energy and money on such strange phenomena. That's the name of her book. She'll join us today to talk about it after the news.
Hey, Radio West listener. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For more than 40 years now, the U.S. government has been conducting experiments on the mental powers of human beings. You know, whether people can read other people's minds or move things with their mind. And when I say the government, I mean a lot of it. The Defense Department, including all branches of the military, the CIA, the Secret Service. I'm talking spending taxpayers' hard-earned money on ESP or dowsing or spoon bending. It all sounds ridiculous, of course, and much of it was, most of it was. But the journalist Annie Jacobson says they had reasons, certainly good intentions, for testing the possibilities of the paranormal. What if you could use the gifts of a psychic or a mind reader to find a hostage or locate a bomb or crack a secret code? Jacobson's new book is about this secret history. It's called Phenomena, and she's joining us today to talk about it. Jacobson is the author of a number of books, including Area 51 and The Pentagon's Brain, which was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in history. She joined us from a studio in Los Angeles, and we began the conversation with a story, a good one, that Jacobson heard on the radio.
So this was one of the early inspirations for the book, and I was driving in my car in Los Angeles listening to the radio, and I was actually listening to a mathematician, a professor of mathematics, tell this story about Anthony Hopkins to a journalist. And the story goes like this. It's back in 1972. Hopkins is in London, and he's going around to bookstores looking for a copy of a semi-obscure book called The Girl from Petrovka. And the reason he wants this book is he's going to be the lead in this film, and he wants the book for research. But everywhere he goes, he can't find the book in the shop, so he heads back, and there on a bench in the underground, he sees a book, and he looks closely, and the book is the book that he had been looking for. But here's where it got stranger still. He opened up the book, as he tells the story, and in the margins there are some notations, as if someone has been writing things about the book in the margins. And, you know, he's very curious about it. And several months later, when he's on set filming The Girl from Petrovka, he meets the author, a man by the name of George Pfeiffer. And he tells Pfeiffer this remarkable story. Pfeiffer says to him, "Would you show me your copy of this book that you found?" He shows it to him, and Pfeiffer says, "That's my handwriting. I wrote those notations. I am the author. I wrote the notations for a translation I was doing. I gave this copy of the book to a friend of mine who lost it. And now here it is. It's come back to me." Well, hearing this story on the radio, I had to pull my car over to kind of hear what was going to come next. I was waiting for what this professor of mathematics would say. And what he said was that this could all be explained by science, by the laws of mathematics. And then he said that anyone who, like, ascribed the words mysterious or miraculous to this story were, in his opinion, somehow intellectually inferior. And that puzzle became very interesting to me, this idea that one side of the aisle says that things, all things, can be explained by science and by mathematics, and the other side says things like, that's mysterious, that's miraculous. That was my entree point to find out more about the phenomena, the government's decades-long investigation into things like extrasensory perception, psychokinesis, map dowsing.
But what's the working question here that you're trying to get at? I mean, there are goats and sheep, as one psychologist lays out. Those who want to believe, those who are skeptical. And because part of the answer could be just that the government, for a time in our history, gave in to credulity. But you say there's more to it than that.
So consider this. Okay, so I'm a national security reporter. I write about war, weapons, security, and secrets. So everything I look at falls under the, you know, access of science and technology as we move forward from, World War II moving forward. Yeah. All the stories I write, the books I write, deal with science and technology leading the intelligence community, leading the military community. Go back in history and then go into prehistory, okay? Mm. And you realize that superstition and magic influenced national security in ways that science and technology do now.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, was my question, was why is it then that we have elements of, and this is in quotes, the supernatural, the magical, the miraculous, the mysterious, still being looked at by the intelligence community, by the Defense Department, not just looked at, but actually used in an operational capability?
Yeah.
What is up with that? That's what I wanted
to
answer.
Right. So you write that your intention is not to prove or disprove any of that part. You say that most of the books that you've seen on the subject take a side. You didn't want to take a side. But still, and I wanted to ask you this, do you ever feel like, you know, there's that intense level of skepticism? And I'm sure you're seeing it in the reaction to the book, perhaps. And I'm wondering if you worry that that's going to keep people from really understanding what you're getting at in the book, or even enjoying the book.
Absolutely. I mean, look, in the opening story we talked about here, the mathematics professor, who is a former president of the Royal Statistical Society of the UK, you know, very prestigious title. I mean, he suggested almost in no uncertain terms that anyone who is even thinking about these kind of things anymore in our age of advanced technology, that they are intellectually inferior. And that is an interesting and important point to me because, yes, absolutely. I mean, scientific skepticism is so significant and important in many ways. But I also like to hold the idea, for me personally and also as a journalist, that keeping an open mind is imperative for advancing knowledge. Curiosity. This phenomena is a book really about what are the outer reaches of what can be known by man.
Seems like I'm asking this question a lot these days of a lot of guests who have certain kinds of books. What does it mean in the era of President Donald Trump to have written this book? And I noticed in one of the reviews of your book that it pointed out the timing. It begins at, you know, it comes out at a time when there's this presidency that, as this reviewer put, thrives on conspiracy and this distortion of fact. So I wanted to sort of just get this out of the way. Does your book actually even indirectly kind of speak to that at all?
Well, it speaks to many of the issues that one deals with in national security. Yeah. Let's go back to Gertrude Schmeidler for a moment. That's the Harvard experimental psychologist who began working in this field in the 40s and created that system of talking about people's belief systems. So on the one hand, Schmeidler said there are goats.
Yeah.
Those are the hardcore scientific skeptics who maintain the position no matter what. All of this, ESP, PK, etc., is hogwash. It is pseudoscience. That's their position.
Yeah.
On the other side of the spectrum, you have the sheep, the people who are open to the idea that ESP, PK, etc. may exist, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, what I found fascinating is that in the scientific community, and the most book reviewers, let's say, are goats, right?
Yeah,
specific scientific skeptics for a very and are loud about it, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
And yet if you look at the Gallup polls, you learn that 76% of Americans are sheep and 24% are goats.
Yeah.
And so people have very clear ideas about what they are open to. And I think if you hold that idea in one hand and then you look at Donald Trump or any of the presidents, for that matter, that become embroiled in discussions about conspiracy, I think it opens up the conversation to a bigger, more interesting thought experiment about what does this mean to us individually.
Right.
It's not an easy answer.
No. So most of the story plays out after World War II, but let's back up a bit, as you do in the book early on. And talk about the story that you tell in the book about how British intelligence may have manipulated this high-ranking Nazi official, people probably know the name, Rudolf Hess, by essentially recruiting a witch or an astrologer to provide these phony horoscopes. That's such a great story. Start with that, if you would.
I mean, think about it. You've got the number two in Nazi Germany, Rudolf Hess, who leaves the side of the Führer to defect to England, where he crashes his plane in the Scottish Highlands on the advice of an astrologer, who we now know, thanks to declassified documentation that I report in the book, was likely part of a black propaganda campaign by MI6, British intelligence.
Yeah.
I mean, what a web of deception and influence operations. And this is absolutely apropos to what we're talking about today. And I think the point is that, oh, these ideas are old. Yeah. Just as so is superstition and so is magic.
Right.
But it's not as simple. It's not as black and white. It's not as right and wrong as some may like to suggest.
There's this really interesting story you tell about this man named Louis de Waal, who's an astrologer, and he becomes incredibly popular during World War II. But it turns out he works for British intelligence, and I'm not sure if you were able to confirm this, but basically he gave these fake predictions, astrology readings, I guess, to sway public opinion in America to get us to join the war effort.
At the same time that this Hess affair was going on, there's a story I report in Phenomena that I absolutely was able to fact check, or this is where the story came from, British intelligence, the archives, which is that and remember, this is 1940. This is early in the war when America is not yet in the war. And Britain's position is we need the American war machine. How are we going to do it? They come up with a plan to send this astrologer, Louis de Waal, to the United States, where his column, Stars Foretell, becomes extraordinarily popular. But what British intelligence is doing is they're feeding de Waal information that cannot be quickly fact-checked by the American media in the decades before Twitter.
Right.
And so there's a delay. De Waal saying XYZ is going to happen, always on the axis of Nazi Germany. And lo and behold, the predictions are coming true. DeWall experiences this meteoric success, and the FCC changes its law prohibiting astrologers on the airwaves. And he delivers his message now to 39 million Americans. The reason why this is important is, again, here we have influence operations, black propaganda, you know, however you want to describe it, this is misinformation inserted into American, you know, zeitgeist,
yeah,
so as to change perception. The idea was to make Hitler appear as this menacing threat and get America into the war. And we know now this was a propaganda campaign.
That's Annie Jacobson. Her book is Phenomena, The Secret History of the U.S. Government's Investigation into Extrasensory Perception and Psychokinesis. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the investigative journalist Annie Jacobson about the U.S. government's secret experiments into mind powers and the paranormal. Her new book is called Phenomena. You've done your share of these investigative projects. You mention in the book you interviewed 55 scientists and psychics. So a lot of work here, and a lot of this information just becoming declassified. Some of it may still be classified. I know this involved Freedom of Information Act requests. I mean, what were you able to uncover, and what is still out there, do you figure?
Well, you know, what I was really intrigued by sort of midway into the research and reporting of this book was that these programs are still going on today. So it's kind of a multi-part answer here, which is that Freedom of Information Act requests filed by me and, you know, received by the CIA, delivered to me more than 1,000 pages of documents that I don't believe had ever been seen before. There are tens of thousands of pages of documents on the psychic programs of the 70s and the 80s that are now at the National Archives that can be looked at. But these new programs, the programs of the present day, had not been comprehensively reported before in sort of chronology of the bigger programs. So what's happening today is that the Defense Department is using advanced technology to reboot these old programs of the 70s and 80s that were called remote viewing, that had to do with psychics.
Yeah.
And they have now rebranded them under this idea of anomalous cognition. One of the programs at the Office of Naval Research is called, the doctors there talk about trying to determine how some soldiers have the spidey sense.
Yeah.
This is remarkable to me, and particularly interesting is the fact that what I was able to report about the modern day programs clearly are the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
Because history shows us that whatever a journalist is able to talk about in the present day, when you're talking about classified SAP programs, special access programs, is a tiny portion of the bigger program underneath.
But the scope of it that really kicks in the 60s, and I think 1972 is this really important time, which we'll get back to, but the scope of it at the time, I mean, out-of-body experiences and skin reading and dowsing and remote viewing, as you mentioned, I mean, this whole list of things, you don't think there's still that scope is part of the things they're looking into now, do you, or do you?
Well, I'm speculating here,
yeah,
but I would say yes, because in all of the four books I have written, where I focus on Cold War classified programs that become declassified, I am able to demonstrate that what the public was made privy to is a tiny fraction of what that big portion is.
Yeah.
And so I think that speculation that I'm saying just comes from experience of looking, you know, the backward glance to demonstrate how big these classified programs really are. And also the idea that, you know, in all the programs, whether it's at the CIA or at the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, or at the Army, the programs, these phenomena programs that have to do with ESP, psychokinesis, map dowsing, they generally begin as small research programs. The idea of, okay, let's try to find out if this is fact or fantasy, and we'll put some physicists on it and some science, some physiologists and neurophysiologists, and then we'll go from there. And then what happens is that very quickly the program goes operational. In other words, the psychic is put to the test and delivers some astonishing piece of information that ends up getting called actionable intelligence.
Right.
And then the powers that be suddenly say, well, forget about the research part, give me more. And then the program goes operational, and that's kind of where the chaos begins, as I write in Phenomena. And again, this is repeating itself through the different decades, because you're now taking a program operational that didn't have its proper research foundation in order.
Yeah.
And this is that idea, I think, of repeating the same mistake that becomes super interesting and part of the narrative.
Yeah. That Cold War motivation, I think, is important to understand, because that's when the story really picks up, is in those years after World War II when the Cold War begins. And you write about how the fact that the Nazis, as you put it, mixed magic with science and technology, wasn't really understood very well at the time, but it became part of that Cold War arms race. The Americans are trying to get the upper hand on the Soviets, and they, since they didn't know much about this stuff, they were willing to do all kinds of experiments, I suppose.
You know, at the end of the war, our intelligence collection unit called Operation Alsace grabs this cache of documents from Heinrich Himmler's pseudoscience organization,
yeah,
Das Annenerbe, where he's trying to prove, you know, why the Aryan race is superior. And inside of that, you know, that archive, Alsace finds this cache of documents that talk about the supernatural, that talk about ESP, map dowsing, psychokinesis, telekinesis. And, you know, you could think, okay, well, that's where the story would end. I mean, the Alsace throws them out and says, well, this is nonsense, this is garbage.
Yeah.
Except, as I learned in reporting this book, the Soviets got the other half of the cache of documents. I mean, we don't know exactly how much, but they got some too. And as you point out, in the Cold War arms race, anything that we, the Americans, had that we suspect that the Soviets had as well becomes its own arms race. And this is kind of the origin story of the psychic arms race in the modern era.
Which brings us to one of the first great characters in the book, a man by the name of Henry Puharich. Am I getting
that's
that
right?
Right. Is it Andrija? His kind of his
yes,
nickname?
He went by Andrea Andrija.
He's this research scientist and a really fascinating man. Grows up in the slums of Chicago, and he has this experience, which I wanted to ask you about, that really leads him to start thinking about this mind-to-mind telepathy. Talk a little bit about that early experience that shapes his mind.
Puharich tells this story later, so it's an interesting kind of backward glance story. But he tells it to his group of benefactors, who, by the way, happen to be the DuPonts and the Forbes and the Astors and these kind of very elite, esoteric bunch. He tells this story to them about when he was a child and his first experience with the phenomena. And he describes being, you know, a poor kid in the slums who is a milk delivery boy. And he gets cornered by a vicious dog that he is convinced is about to rip him to shreds. And suddenly, he gets this idea to communicate with the dog, he says. And he kind of, you know, talks the dog out of the tree, if you will. And the dog backs down. And he becomes obsessed with this idea, and that there is some kind of, telepathy between animals. And that becomes the basis, he says, for his interest in, you know, biology, in human physiology. And ultimately, he becomes a medical doctor. And that is his approach into all of this phenomena work, is as a doctor looking at human physiology, trying to figure out whether or not extrasensory perception, the sixth sense, is something within.
How influential is he on the way these various programs play out? Because he has boundless energy, he's charismatic. It seems like he had a lot of influence in all of this.
He did, and he also, was one of the earliest sort of progenitors of all of this work. In the book Phenomena, he stands for me as a cautionary tale, because on the one hand, he is this brilliant doctor, and in my read of him and my read of his life, I was also able to find documents at the Library of Congress, which I don't believe have been seen, you know, since they were filed away in the 50s, letters that he wrote to his benefactors, in particular Marcella DuPont, who was paying for a lot of his early research. Puharich goes off the rails. He starts out with this idea that it's within, it's biological. And that's where he catches the attention of the Defense Department, and he's recruited back into the Army Chemical Center to look at this program that the CIA is working with the Army Chemical Center on to see, we're in the mid-50s now, to see if you give drugs to people who have the gift, people who are inclined toward extrasensory perception, if you can somehow enhance this in them. And it gets very tangled up. Puharich begins taking the drugs himself, and he really winds up, some would say, going off the rails. Others would say, you know, he was pursuing ideas that were way ahead of his time.
Yeah. You ask this question in the book. Was Puharich a deceiver? Was he delusional? Have you come to a conclusion, or do you want to say?
I think it's more interesting if the reader decides that. I do present a whole lot of information which had never been reported before about him, specifics about some of these interesting different programs he was working on. I mean, because he was involved in the MK Ultra program, and because that early CIA mind control program has so much baggage attached to it, I think it's interesting in the way in which the new information I report allows readers to see, you know, conspiracy from a different perspective. And I think part of the enjoyment of reading Phenomena is seeing how Puharich's life unfolds over the decades. I mean, he kind of like touches upon these incredible moments in the government's history of this work, all the way until his very tragic death in the mid-90s, when he dies kind of alone, living with a bunch of feral cats, and yet he's in the home of, you know, one of the heirs of the Reynolds tobacco fortune, because one of the things Puharich was able to do his whole life was captivate these extraordinarily wealthy people's attention and their desire to unravel mysteries and pay for it.
Yeah. Talk about something that happens in 1959. It's this story you tell. There's this article that comes out about the American ESP program by a Jacques Bergier. He's a former French resistance spy. And he tells the story of this sailor on this American vessel. So they're going way up north, and he's trying to send these ESP messages using these cards far out in sea to someone in Maryland. I think this is such an interesting story. Say something about this, if you would.
Well, it's another origin story of ESP in the military, if you will, because and again, this is a very controversial story because even amongst the sheep, there is a great divide between those that say this story was made up, it never happened, and those who insist it did happen.
Yeah.
And I really am fascinated by how these different battlegrounds unfold. And, you know, what is also important to this story is that the Soviets then say, and I think they say this with deception, well, the whole reason we began our program was because the U.S. began their program on that submarine.
Right.
Well, that was handy in the 70s when that may or may not have been true. But what we now know is that the Soviet program began way back at the end of, you know, World War II, when they captured the other half of the Das Annenerbe documents.
Navy called it a hoax.
The Navy called it a hoax, but I love these stories, and they kind of intersect with the other books I write, you know, Area 51 having to do with the Roswell incident,
right,
whereby when you have a military situation where a commanding officer steps forward and says, yes, I did that, and or yes, X, Y, or Z happened. And then shortly thereafter, the bureaucracy steps in and says, no, 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 that was said in error.
Yeah.
It didn't happen. That is that's the origin story of a conspiracy theory right there.
Right.
And that becomes interesting to me.
Well, and we should mention also that a good part of the book is exploring the goat side of this, the skepticism. In 1952, you write about the publication of this book called Fads and Fallacies in the Name of Science by a man by the name of Martin Gardner. Maybe this is one of those origin stories of the movement of scientific skepticism. Talk about that part, because that idea of skepticism is an important part of this story, too.
It has to be. I mean, and Martin Gardner himself is a fascinating figure because he writes this book and he talks about, you know, with very serious concern about pseudoscience and ideas that the world is flat and people are believing these things. He talks about this new thing called cybernetics, which later, you know, he's talking about early days of Scientology.
Yeah.
And he has a valid point. I think in all of this, there's always gray areas. I mean, Gardner also blamed a lot of this on, you know, sort of bored housewives, which I thought was interesting. And he blames a lot of it on the Nazis. And he says, belief in the supernatural, I'm paraphrasing, gives way to fascism. And, you know, I found that very black and white. But what I found most interesting about Martin Gardner and his, you know, enormous following, and again, they have absolutely legitimate points. And let's remind listeners right away that the phenomena do not pass the scientific method.
Yeah.
That is a key element here.
Very.
I mean, since the scientific revolution, everyone agrees, follow certain steps, and then this experiment must be repeatable to call it science.
Yeah.
Well, the phenomena may be phenomenal in their extraordinary in specific instances, but everyone will tell you they cannot be repeated in a laboratory. The scientists in the work say, that is why this is in the hypothesis stage, and one day we will move toward general theory. The scientific skeptics, led by Martin Gardner, say, nonsense. Okay.
Do you think that that's because there must have been limitations on this process of scientific rigor if you're working for the government in these classified conditions? I mean, how do you do peer review when you're trying to keep everything so secret?
Great point. I mean, look, you know, these are mysteries inside puzzles inside mysteries, and everybody has a valid point. What I find super interesting is how the battlefield, you know, grows.
Sandy Jacobson, her book is called Phenomena. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Annie Jacobson. We're talking about her book, Phenomena. I want to talk about Edgar Mitchell. He's such a great character, and you seem to have such an affection for him. Let's talk about who he is. He's the sixth astronaut who goes to the moon. And let's back up and just explain, when does he first become fascinated by this idea of mental telepathy? Because I think it would be fair to say he kind of becomes obsessed by this.
Absolutely he does. So back up a moment before that, which is how I even became interested in Ed Mitchell. I was researching DARPA, the Pentagon's brain, about DARPA, my previous book, and in the Apollo image library, I came across this image of an astronaut standing on the moon reading a document. And this blew my mind. I mean, it was this marvelous idea that you had these two concepts in one image. You had advanced science, space travel, and you had protos, like the origin of tools of technology, which is writing and reading, in one image. But I wanted to know what on earth was an astronaut doing reading something on the moon, and what was he reading?
Yeah.
I found out it was Ed Mitchell, Apollo 14. I went to his house to interview him, and he told me that he was reading a map. So here's a image of an astronaut on the moon reading a map of the moon. Even more remarkable. And the reason he was reading this map was because he and his fellow astronaut, Alan Shepard, had gotten lost. So they had traveled 240,000 miles, hit the target, to then get lost locally. And the results of being lost were devastating, a longer story. But what was remarkable to me, knowing at this point that Ed Mitchell was interested in ESP,
yeah,
on his moon voyage, was that that's where he found himself lost. And being lost is a quintessential metaphor in this book, Phenomena, and really all of my research and reporting. Because what does it mean to get lost? How do you find your way back? And how is being lost part and parcel to exploration, to advancing knowledge?
Ed Mitchell is thinking about ESP. He's trying to... there's a moment when he's in space trying to transmit these images to a friend back on Earth. And you write about how he feels this sense of psychological tension in the lunar module. He even has a sense that he may have fixed a panel with his mind when they go through this... probably a long story here too, but you know, this instrument panel problem. So there's that side of him where he thinks that his mind is maybe influencing things. And there's the other part of the story, I guess, which is the critique of all of that. And I'm wondering what you make of it, because you say Ed Mitchell is one of your heroes.
So Mitchell and Shepard get lost on the moon.
Yeah.
And what happens is that NASA, who can, you know, read their physiology in real time, realizes that their heart rate is up and they're running out of oxygen. Their goal is to find this crater on the moon called Cone Crater, inside of which they're supposed to bring home some rock samples, which may, geologists back on Earth believe, be able to solve the mystery of how the moon was created. I mean, think about that as a challenge.
Yeah.
And because they've gotten lost, they can't get to Cone Crater. They're told to turn around. They have to go back, and now they're on their way home. Ed Mitchell, the way he described this story to me, was devastated, okay? And he's looking out the window, and he has this epiphany where he realizes, he says, that man is more than he believes he is, that man is somehow connected to this greater consciousness. And the experience is so impactful to Ed Mitchell. It's what I call in the book a conversion event.
Yeah.
And he's not the only individual in Phenomena who has a conversion event.
Yeah.
But it means so much to him that he comes back, he lands on Earth, he quits NASA, he divorces his wife, he makes all new friends and colleagues, and he dedicates the rest of his life to inquiring and studying extrasensory perception and psychokinesis. And he has conviction, but for that he is absolutely ridiculed.
Yeah.
He's made fun of by all of his former friends. Now, keep in mind, Mitchell has a PhD from MIT at this point. He's a man of science, but he's ridiculed because he was such a, you know, Apollo astronaut is a huge figure, and you are supposed to toe the party line. Mitchell did not do that.
Yep.
And, you know, he suffered. He suffered. I write in the book about his suffering. And then he develops these theories which many people would call bananas, you know. He kind of goes off the rails, if you will,
yeah,
about, according to some, let's say, about,
sure,
you know, ideas about extraterrestrials. But separate that, as I ask the reader to do, from the fact that what Mitchell did on the moon was extraordinary. I mean, you can read the 1,200-page transcript of what transpired on the moon, as I did, or you can read the couple chapters in my book where I summarize it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really find it difficult for anyone to go away and say, ah, that's no big deal, I could have done that. I mean, they had extraordinary challenges. I mean, things went wrong left and right. And remember, Apollo 14 came after Apollo 13.
Mm-hmm.
So they could not make a mistake. And if they did, they had to pretend they didn't, because the whole program was going to be canceled. And so Mitchell does these extraordinary things on the moon. And so, okay, he has extraordinary ideas. Does that somehow negate his heroism?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a zero-sum game here.
Yeah.
At least it wasn't to me. And I felt compelled to write his story in this book, because you may not agree with his ideas, but to ridicule him seemed extremely short-sighted to me as a reporter.
Well, you write that maybe the true energy source behind all of this phenomena is a conviction, a conviction of belief. Would you explain that?
The skeptics would tell you that that's the placebo effect.
Yeah.
This idea that you can give someone a harmless pill, tell them that it's medicine, and it will have a physiological effect on their body. Well, I think that's exactly the point I'm demonstrating. I mean, I do not have the answer, but I find it super interesting if man's conviction allows for certain things to happen. And that is why I bring up in the book and thread through the narrative this idea called the Thomas Theorem, mm-hmm, which says, you know, if man perceive their situations to be real, they have real consequences. And boy, when you're writing and reporting about the CIA and the Defense Department, I assure you, the Thomas Theorem comes into play, because there are real, real consequences to the convictions of men.
Yeah. We don't have time to go through all of the programs. I mean, it's a massive book that gets at extraordinary details. So I'll just sort of commit listeners to find these stories, because there's the real action, you say, begins in 1972, and the CIA enlists these young scientists, and then things really, everyone wants to get into the act. The Navy, the Air Force, the Army, the Coast Guard, the DEA, which is amazing. The Secret Service gets involved. So there's all of these programs and all of these different departments. But in the interest of time, I want to move to another really fascinating character, because he plays an important role, and that's Uri Geller. You mentioned how Ed Mitchell receives all of this criticism. He's crushed by it. Geller isn't. Tell a little bit about his story. I think people probably know him. You may remember him from, he used to come on Johnny Carson and he would bend spoons, but he's a fascinating character. Tell us a little bit about Uri Geller.
He is a fascinating character, and as a national security reporter, I was intrigued by the fact that Uri Geller in 1972, thanks to these declassified documents, we now know he was a CIA asset,
yeah,
meaning they were interested in him. They were interested in knowing how his physiology worked the way it did. And I interviewed Dr. Christopher Green, mm-hmm, who was the doctor who was in charge, you know, he says, Green says, I was sometimes called the guy on the weird desk at CIA. So when the CIA is running their program in the 70s at the Stanford Research Institute, led by a physicist named Hal Puthoff, they've got Green looking at the psychics' biology, trying, you know, giving them every kind of test you can think of, similar to what the astronauts had to go through, to try and determine if this sixth sense is something from within. And so that's where we meet Geller. And then he intersects in a strange way with national security elements throughout the narrative. And he also intersects with Puharich, and he intersects with Ed Mitchell. And this is the kind of reporting I find fascinating, where, you know, the general public believes such and such a story to be true. Uri Geller, and then you can fill in the blanks. I mean, and yet you can look a bit deeper beneath the surface, examine the now declassified CIA documents, the now declassified Defense Department documents, and realize, oh, there's a very different story about Uri Geller that is yet unreported, and that's what I wanted to report in the book.
You went and interviewed him. In fact, you've interviewed him a number of times. You mentioned your first interview. I think this was just a few years ago. You went to visit him in England. And you say you were doing your best to remain objective and detached, I think is the word you put. But there was something about him that was pretty captivating. It captivated your attention. What do you make now, I suppose, and even then, of Uri Geller?
I think that goes back to that idea of conviction.
Yeah.
And also, having spent time with Mitchell interviewing him, and although he was very content at the end of his life, I think I did the last interview with him before he passed. You could tell that he was aware. My interpretation was that he was aware of how he had suffered from being ridiculed.
Yeah.
And he was also aware of the fact that Geller had risen above the mayhem, if you will, the criticism, and just lived this extraordinary life. And again, you know, I can hear the scientific skeptics wincing, because this is exactly what they use to build up this idea that Geller is a charlatan and a snake oil salesman and a fraudster, and people are entitled to their opinions.
Yeah.
That was not mine. I found Geller to be extraordinarily charismatic, and I also found it very interesting that he amassed extraordinary wealth from his talents. He became a map dowser.
Yeah.
Map dowsing is this idea that you could swing a pendulum over a map and locate a hidden treasure, locate something underground. Well, Geller in the 80s, and this is reported in, you know, foreign economic magazines as well, began teaming up with mining companies and working to help them identify where minerals were and where oil reserves were. And whereas he started out working for £1 million fee, British sterling, he then became so successful that he started to take a percentage of the royalties of what was located. And from that, Geller has, you know, extraordinary wealth. And he's open about that. And I find that interesting. Again, I don't have the answer.
Yeah.
Map dowsing is something that, you know, even the Geological Society is very clear is pseudoscience. How it works, a mystery. But Geller is super interesting. And I write in the end of the book that, you know, he also has a home in Israel.
Yeah.
And there was a myth that I heard that Geller worked for Mossad. Back in the 70s, it was more than a myth. In the declassified documents, you see it's actually a concern.
Yeah.
The CIA has to let him go because he is an Israeli citizen, and they are visited by, you know, men in dark suits, let's say. That's how it's described,
right,
who they believe are with Mossad. So the real question I was after when I went to interview Geller in Israel was, you know, is this fantasy that he works for Mossad? Is this kind of like the James Bond fantasy? And while he wouldn't say, I did find myself with Geller being taken to a mysterious home. And that mysterious home turned out to be the home of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yeah.
And all of the guards, all of the security absolutely knew Uri Geller and, you know, asked him to bend a couple spoons for their kids while we were there.
Well, and you mentioned the news that comes from Israel, how they had discovered this tunnel from Gaza into Israel, and it made you wonder if there hadn't been some kind of map dowsing. I don't know what to make of it either. It's mystifying, but fascinating. And it's not that long ago that these stories are playing out.
Absolutely. And if you're willing to not take a position, okay, I'm not a sheep, I'm not a goat, I'm just going to try to look at this neutral. You know, it's a super entertaining, interesting story to just live in that position, which is, you know, I don't know the answer. I do not know, you know, who Geller really is and what he really is doing.
Yeah.
And that, for me, is okay in this exploration of the central question of the book, which is, what are the outer reaches of man's knowledge? What is man capable of knowing?
Let me ask you this finally. You write near the end of the book that as new documents become declassified and as more people come out and talk about their involvement in these programs, that we're going to start to get maybe, anyway, more clarity. What do you figure that means, more clarity?
I think it means that the age in which we live now, with technology advancing at this astonishing rate, and with, you know, nanobiotechnology existing. I mean, these are concepts that people couldn't have even fathomed 15 years ago. Being able to look inside the human brain, being able to look inside the body, and then being able to use computer technology to read what is going on inside individual people. I think that there will be advances made, and I have learned about old CIA program directors and scientists, and I write about this in the book, teaming up in a civilian laboratory at Stanford called the Nolan Lab, where they are working to see if genomics will solve this mystery. What they are searching for is the genomics of not the paranormal, but the genomics of the supernormal.
Sandy Jacobson, investigative journalist. Her book is Phenomena, the Secret History of the U.S. Government's Investigations into Extrasensory Perception and Psychokinesis. She joined us today from a studio in Los Angeles. Annie Jacobson, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We want to welcome our new intern, Zoe Wolf-McGinn. Technical direction today from Adrian Moranville. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.